Just one moment.
Good?
Yeah, that's good.
Okay.
Can't just follow.
We do want to record the exciting motion. Okay, good afternoon, everybody. Thank you for this opportunity to speak here today. Today I'll be talking about Hamiltonian oracles, which are the continuous version of the unitary oracles which we all know and love. The idea of the Hamiltonian oracle is very old. It dates back to 1996 when Farkin and Guttman came up with an analog of Grover's search, that is a continuous version of Grover's search. And since then, there have been a few, this research has been taken a few directions, mainly towards continuous random walks and continuous spatial searching, but very few other oracles have been examined in this context. And I really think that that's a change. So today's talk is not so much a presentation of an exciting new result, but rather it's a sermon preaching the goodness, the potential, the wonder that is Hamiltonian oracles. And hopefully some of the ideas that I have will be illustrated with some new results along the way. Now, I would like to begin my sermon by reading a passage from the Book of Bacon. And that state Bacon, of course, who discusses the difference between computer scientists and physicists, and he says the following. Physicists are the ones who think that NP stands for not polynomial, and computer scientists are the ones who think that a Hamiltonian is some sort of sandwich. So, you know, in case there are any computer scientists who manage to sneak into the audience, I should just let you know, this talk is not about sandwiches. You're going to be disappointed and hungry. Actually, this reflects part of the problem that we have with the Hamiltonian oracles, that Hamiltonians are something that are very natural to physicists, but somewhat obscure to computer scientists. And oracles are very natural to computer scientists, but often obscure to physicists. The intersection of the two subjects is something that's typically avoided by both parties, and that's something I'm trying to change today. So if it's not a sandwich, what is it? Well, it's an operator that lives inside a Schrodinger equation and generates unitaries. I really do hope you all know what a Hamiltonian is, because I won't go into detail explaining that. I will try to explain briefly, though, what a Hamiltonian oracle is. So, the idea is there's going to be a set of Hamiltonians, possibly all Hamiltonians, indexed by some parameter x. Nature comes along, chooses x, and applies it to your system. You can also, you yourself, add a second term to the total Hamiltonian of your system, which is going to be h prime. And your h prime is your control Hamiltonian. That control Hamiltonian can be time dependent, and can be arbitrarily complicated, arbitrarily strong, can be anything you want, but it cannot depend on x in any way, so that parameter you don't know. To make this problem non-trivial, we should also demand that the initial state of the Schrodinger equation is going to be independent of x. Now your goal is to find x, or possibly just some property of x, such as whether it's even or odd. And you want to do this as quickly as possible. To give a very, very concrete model, take the n-dimensional system with n different Hamiltonians, possible Hamiltonian oracles, each of which marks exactly one basis state. If the goal is to figure out which marked states we have, then this is a continuous Grover search problem. Now, I should mention a number of caveats or notes to this slide. The first thing, why am I calling these Hamiltonian oracles? Well, obviously because these are the continuous versions of unitary oracles. If we had a unitary oracle, we'd have pretty much the same setup. We'd have a set of unitaries where nature comes along and chooses one of them. We also have a control unitary that we get to apply, which can be arbitrarily complicated. The only big difference is that in the unitary case, there's a staggered application of the unitaries. First the control unitary, then the oracle unitary, then control unitary, then, and so on. Whereas here, they're really happening both at the same time. At the end, though, your goal is to figure out something about this. Now, the second note I should point out is that there are really many ways of finding this problem of Hamiltonian oracles. You might want to allow the person who's doing this computation to stop the evolution at a given point, apply a unitary, and then restart the Schrodinger equation. Alternatively, you might want to do what I call something ultra-fast unitary, which is simply applied unitary so quickly that it seems instantaneous from the point of view of the dynamics of the Schrodinger equation. You may also want to allow the application of conjugates of the Hamiltonian oracle, or maybe even convex combinations of conjugates of the Hamiltonian oracle. The kind of stuff that you get by cauterizing the equation. And so I conjecture that all of these models and all reasonable models of the cross-plane Hamiltonian oracles are equivalent. And I can offer you, though I won't do it in this talk, a physicist proof of this fact. However, a good mathematical proof of this is actually an open problem, and I think it really needs to be written down somewhere. However, my goal today is not really to pin down a particular model or to prove equivalences between different models, but rather to just pick a model, run with it, and come up with a few examples, come up with a few consequences. The third caveat that I should say is that if you may really see this and say, well, what you're trying to do is there's a Hamiltonian, it's an unknown Hamiltonian, and you're trying to figure out what it is. Well, back in my day, we used to call that physics. And in some sense, that's true. Because what is physics? Physics is, here's a crystal, it has an unknown Hamiltonian, I'm going to apply some external fields and try to find out what it is. Or here's a universe, I'm going to tinker around a little bit in the universe and try to find out what's the Hamiltonian of the universe. And so this problem of figuring out what a Hamiltonian is really what we normally call physics. But what I think of Hamiltonian oracles is a very, very tiny subset of this big problem of identifying Hamiltonian. And it's this subset, or the subproblem, is going to be characterized by three problems. First, that the hidden parameter is really going to take values along a discrete finite set, which usually can be labeled by bit strings. More importantly, these Hamiltonians are typically going to couple a logarithmic number of particles, rather than, say, a fixed number of particles that are nearest neighbors. So it's a little bit stronger than the kind of Hamiltonian you'd expect in physics. On the other hand, they're also going to be somewhat easier or simpler than the kind of Hamiltonian you'd expect in physics. Probably they'll all be back on the same basis. They'll all have eigenvalues 0 and plus or minus pi. The normalization of 0 and plus or minus pi is so that 1 second of evolution of this Hamiltonian generates a unitary whose eigenvalue is plus or minus 1. Furthermore, the counting of resources is very different. I'm allowing you to basically do anything you want with your control Hamiltonian, which an experimentalist might very well scoff at. Arbitrarily strong fields, arbitrarily complicated fields, arbitrarily fast changes to the Hamiltonian. So I don't really care about that. The only thing I care about is query time, query time, query. How long does this take? And so this defines what I really think of the problem of Hamiltonian oracle. The broader problem of identifying a Hamiltonian that's unknown really is a big problem. Let's go by a number of names inside the literature. Hamiltonian identification, parameter estimation, or as I mentioned earlier, physics. However, most of these really have a very small intersection only with this problem of Hamiltonian oracles. They're generally disjoint. So, with that in mind, I should mention, well, what are they related to? As I mentioned before, is unitary oracles. And I like to make that precise. And so the idea is that a standard unitary oracle, just consider one query, is going to be the application of the unitary operator followed by, of a unitary control, which can be arbitrary, followed by the unitary oracle. And I want you to think of this process as taking 1 second in time. And the reason I want to do this is because I'm always going to relate Hamiltonian oracles to unitary oracles by this equation on the screen, which basically says that the unitary is generated by 1 second of evolution of the Hamiltonian. And so under these conditions, you can think of the unitary model as, well, there really isn't really, there's an underlying Hamiltonian. And what you did is you evolved the system for a second, and then you get to apply a control unitary. And so the Hamiltonian oracle is very similar as well. I described your Hamiltonian control, sort of an extra term you can add into the Hamiltonian, but equivalently what you could say is you're simply allowed to do unitaries as often as you want. So now we have two models that are very similar. In both of them, we have this one Hamiltonian oracle that's always on. In the discrete case, you get to the unitaries once a second. In the continuous case, you get to the unitaries as often as you want. And that's mainly the difference. And the big consequence that comes out of this is, of course, that the Hamiltonian oracle is a lower bound to the discrete oracle because it has more computational power. Anything I can do in the discrete case, I can also do in the Hamiltonian case. More formally, I could say that the query time needed to solve a Hamiltonian oracle is always a lower bound on the query complexity of the equivalent unitary oracle when they're related by this equation, and this is simply a trivial fact. Okay, so this is, at the moment, my main interest in Hamiltonian oracles. I think of them as a tool for deriving lower bounds on unitary oracles. Now, they also may be worthy of study in their own right. But I think there are a couple of problems with Hamiltonian oracles in the following sense. The motivation for an oracle model is that the oracle query is supposed to capture the hardest part of the computation, and that's why it's the only thing they count for, either a lengthy function computation or a time-consuming memory access. When we have to do the same operation as a Hamiltonian, we really have to do some of this lengthy computation, this time-consuming operation, instantaneously in order to apply the Hamiltonian. And that breaks a little bit of the motivation. Though I think there might be interesting potential. But let's assume that all you're really interested is studying unitary oracles. Then you might ask, well, why not just study unitary oracles? Why bother with this Hamiltonian oracle business in the first place? And so the reason is this slide. And if you're going to pay attention to one slide in this entire talk, this is the slide to pay attention to. I've very, very roughly sketched the evolution of the state under the Unitarian Hamiltonian Grover search problems. And in both cases, the optimal algorithm has a state evolving as a pure state inside a two-dimensional Hilbert space, which is spanned by the initial state and the Mark state. I can plot this evolution on a rock sphere, placing the initial state at the North Pole and the Mark state somewhere close to the South Pole, but not quite at the South Pole. And so, what I have here is the evolution of the state as time passes by. The blue curve is a unitary case. The slanted line corresponds to oracle queries. The horizontal lines correspond to your control unitaries. And given the way I define the model, the slanted lines actually take 1 second, whereas the horizontal lines are instantaneous. Alternatively, if you don't like continuous evolution in a discrete model, you can simply note that as you apply each of the unitaries in turn to the unitary model, the state will pass by each of the vertices of the blue curve. Now on to the green curve. The green curve corresponds to the evolution by the Hamiltonian oracle. There's not much else to say about the green curve, and that's exactly the point. And so this brings me to the punchline of today's talk. Which curve would you rather study? The blue curve or the green curve? Well, I mean, not quite so simple, but I think there are advantages to this Hamiltonian oracle business, even if your only interest is proving lower bounds of unitary oracles. The advantages is sort of continuous curve, which is what the previous picture was trying to describe. It also appears to be simpler to achieve zero error, and I mean the following. Consider the Grover search problem. If you want to achieve zero error, you have to do something really funky with that last query. In the continuous case, all you do is you start advancing. When you get to the Mark state, at the right time, you stop. Very, very simple to get zero error. There are other advantages. Usually, the equations that arise are a continuous version of differential equations, which are often easy to solve in difference equations. There'll even be some connection to differential geometry, and we'll see that today. Finally, possibly the most interesting stuff about Hamiltonian oracles, I won't have time to explore today, but really involve notions such as fractional queries and being able to answer queries at different speeds, all of which sort of appear naturally in this model. On the other side, there are great downsides to this Hamiltonian oracle business. I've taken what was a finite number of variables to optimize over, and now I've transformed it into an infinite number of variables to optimize over. So in some sense, I made the problem much, much, much harder. More importantly is this relationship to geometry. I think it's really nice and allows me to go back to my textbooks on general relativity and apply all the fun knowledge that I gained while studying general relativity. But at the end of the day, geometry is hard. A problem that was hard as a computational problem or the quantum computing problem is likely going to be mapped into a hard problem as a geometry problem. This is not necessarily a magic bullet. Still, I think that being able to see things as a geometry problem could give you a new perspective and new insight into the problem. So, as you mentioned, what prior work has been done. I mentioned earlier, of course, the Farkin-Guffman paper, which is sort of the first paper to describe Hamiltonian oracles and say the modern language. And that has been continued by a number of people who re-examined this continuous growth research, and a number of people who generalize it towards continuous walk and continuous spatial search. There is an enormous literature on the problem of identifying Hamiltonians and all of its variants, depending on what resources you have and what Hamiltonians you're interested in. And I can't possibly list all the people who contributed to that field. But most of it is disjoint from the kind of stuff that I'm interested in Hamiltonian oracles. Finally, I should mention that part of this work was motivated after reading some of the recent papers by Nielsen on geometry and its relationship to deriving lower bounds to deriving circuit lower bounds for quantum computation. And potentially even more related is the work by Kaneki and collaborators, which sort of does a similar relationship between geometry and Hamiltonian identification, though again sort of very different typical Hamiltonians. So what are the results that I have? First result is actually a very small result. It doesn't use any geometry or anything else. And so I'm just going to mention it briefly in this slide because I think it's interesting, but then I won't speak about it for the rest of the talk. The idea is that you can actually do an improvement to the Farkin-Guffman Grover search protocol. The improvement is to some leading order, so computationally it's not very interesting. The leading order is still root n over 2. I should mention that to compare the two results, you always have to be a little bit careful. In the sense that when you're using Hamiltonian oracles, if you simply double the strength of the Hamiltonian, you can solve the problem in twice the time. So, that is a little bit of cheating. You have to fix your normalization. There are a number of papers that simply put an overall constant E. I fixed the normalization in a particular way because I want them to be related to unitary oracles. And that generally involves choosing E equals to pi, and that sort of fixes my notation, and that allows you to compare other results in literature. But just to be aware, there are sort of these different ways of defining this. There has to be a fixed, maximum eigenvalue though, otherwise it's probably trivial. Now, anyways, back to the difference between these results. The improvement is very, very small. But it's interesting to see how it arises. And what happened is, to get this improvement, you don't evolve towards the marked state, but you evolve towards a different state that's close to the marked state, but not quite there. And it turns out that what you really want to do is, if you're promised that the marked state is one of the computational basis states, then all that really matters is that the n different possible evolutions end up at n different orthogonal states. You don't necessarily need to end up at the marked state. And surprisingly enough, if you evolve towards a different state that's not the marked state, you can get this orthogonal condition a little bit faster. Very, very slightly faster. That's all I have to say about that today. I think the more interesting results that I have concern the problem of oracle interrogation, which I'll define right now. Oracle interrogation is very simple. Your hidden parameter is an n-bit string. Your goal is to output the entire n-bit string. The way you can query this n-bit string is you get to query it one bit at a time. What does that mean for a unitary oracle? Well, for a unitary oracle, it means that you're going to have queries that range from 1 to n. And if you query with a state j, then the oracle is going to flip the phase if the jth bit of your string is 1, and you're going to leave the phase the same if the jth bit of your x is 0. What about the Hamiltonian oracle? Well, the Hamiltonian oracle, I chose something a little bit more complicated. It's going to have the same register j, but it's going to have an additional register k, which takes values 0 and 1. So just focus on the k equals 0 block for the moment. And what you can see is that when we order the unitary has eigenvalue 1, the Hamiltonian has eigenvalue 0. When the unitary has eigenvalue minus 1, the Hamiltonian has eigenvalue pi. So this is the Hamiltonian you might be expected to be associated with this particular unitary. What happens when you flip the bit to k equals to 1? Well, then you simply pick up a global minus sign for this Hamiltonian. That is, you get the time-reversed Hamiltonian. And this bit is a bit that basically allows you to go forward or backwards in time. It's a useful trick because it allows you to maintain complex conjugation symmetry throughout the problem, and this was useful in the analysis. At the end of the day, though, if you take the evolution of this Hamiltonian for 1 second, you still get the same unitary oracle tensor with the identity. So in principle, this Hamiltonian can be used to derive lower bounds on this unitary oracle here, just as much as, say, the standard Hamiltonian can be used. So, Sue? Yes?
Could I ask you something about your last slide? When you then will talk about the improvement that you get,
yes.
Will you actually carry out this very difficult functional optimization, or will you just provide some Paul sequence that you that looks reasonable and then compute what it does?
Sorry, can you explain that question again?
Okay.
Two options.
Well, you gave the Hamiltonian. You said you have the Oracle Hamiltonian, and then you have the steering Hamiltonian.
Mm-hmm.
It could be external fields. And of course, you would apply the external fields in such a way that you minimize the Oracle time.
Mm-hmm.
So that leaves you with a very difficult optimization for your field, for your external fields. Transparency, you showed a result. Will that result from an optimization over these external fields, or will you just assume a reasonable external field over time and then compute what it does?
So what I'm saying that I'm basically, from what I understand, the external field is a control Hamiltonian.
Yes.
And I'm finding the optimal sequence of control Hamiltonian, the optimal variation.
Okay, so this
is actually the optimal. Okay. Now it turns out that this optimal is very simple. It's just a constant.
Oops.
So the Farvian government is a constant Hamiltonian. You get this with one constant Hamiltonian, and you get this with a slightly different constant Hamiltonian. So it's not a very complicated sequence of pulses.
Okay.
But in principle, you can't do better than this with a complicated sequence of pulses.
Okay.
Okay, so what are the results? For oracle interrogation, the discrete case was studied by Wim Van Dam, and in a very nice paper he showed that if only about n over 2 of the queries, you can get to a very high probability, you can output the correct string x. However, if you want to have zero error, then you really need to do all n queries. You need to query all n bits. So what can I do for the continuous case? Well, I have two results. The first is simply a lower bound, which simply shows that it's an order n problem that requires order n queries. This is important because if there was a big speed up in the continuous case versus the discrete case, then in principle this Hamiltonian oracle business wouldn't be useful for deriving lower bounds for the discrete case. So they seem to be very closely related here.
It would still be useful for driving lower bounds, but they might not be tight lower bounds.
Yes, but they probably wouldn't be. They may not be interesting lower bounds. They could be, overly trivial. Is what I'm trying to say.
In general, you're not expecting that you're going to be able to get the tight lower bounds in the continuous case either.
The idea is, I don't really care, for instance, what's the coefficient in front of this, but I'd hope that you could get a sort of an order n. Proficient. If the best you could do is sort of a root n instead of an n, then this would be a lot less interesting. Maybe. Hopefully they're as close as possible so that a reasonable bound in the continuous case should give you a reasonable bound in the discrete case. That's ideally the goal. That's an open question, of course. Anyways, I probably won't have time to talk about that lower bound. What I will talk about today is the second result, which is a complete analysis of the n equals 2 case. And there are two interesting things that come out of this analysis of the n equals 2 case. The first is that we find that speedups are possible for zero error in this continuous model. And that's kind of interesting. And the second thing is that this problem is related to a problem in differential geometry, which is simply to take this two-sphere, place this metric on it, and find the minimum distance between the two points at the bottom, pi over 2, comma 0, and pi over 4, comma pi over 4, where this is theta, comma phi. And so the minimum distance between these two points, given that metric, is exactly equal to the minimum amount of time needed to solve this oracle problem. And we'll discuss that a little bit later.
Sorry, the two.
Yes.
Yeah, I'm having trouble understanding those two coordinates. How do you think about them at the very bottom of the slide?
So that's theta comma phi. So theta equals pi over 2, phi equals 0. Theta and phi being the standard polar coordinates for the two-sphere.
Theta is like this, and phi is like this.
No, theta actually goes from the North Pole, and phi goes around.
Okay.
Physicist convention instead of mathematician's convention.
Two-sphere is just a three-dimensional sphere that you think of? Like
so I'm thinking, yeah, so the regular two-sphere embedded, you know, with coordinates saying in the three-sphere. So its metric distance is going to be the form. Yes?
Can you explain that equation?
The ds squared?
Yeah.
Not really, no. to be completely honest, there are going to be a couple of slides at the end where I will do a little bit of differential geometry, and it's going to be kind of hard for me to explain differential geometry if you haven't seen this before. So I'm just going to ask you to bear with me for those three slides towards the end. I'll be happy to try to explain this after the talk. But basically, this basically tries to say it's sort of an infinitesimal distance in different directions has this size. But a better technical description requires a little bit more time than I have for this talk.
So are those two points, like if you sort of divide the two spheres into offsets, then one of them is one of the axes points, and the other one is the middle of one of the offsets?
Yes. Okay, so that concludes the introduction. So the next part is going to be the actual talk. Those of you who are waiting to start doing computer work now, it's a good time to start. Those of you who fall asleep, you can try waking up and refollowing the talk at this point. So the next part of the talk is going to be a quick discussion of sort of the models and the methods that I'm using to study this problem. And the method is basically, look at the grand matrix. And probably most of you are familiar with this, but just in case you aren't, the grand matrix is defined as follows. If x and y are two hidden strings, then psi of x is the state you would have at time t, evolving the oracle, given an algorithm with the hidden oracle x. Psi y of t will be the same thing, but evolving with the oracle y after time t. Their inner product gives the grand matrix. This has some very nice benefits. Starters being that it has some kind of smooth evolution. Smooth not in the mathematical sense, but rather in the following sense. So, since you can do unitaries as often as you want, you can really move the state all over the Hilbert thing very, very quickly. But that's not very interesting because it doesn't differentiate between the different hidden strings. So this grand matrix washes out all those crazy choices you could do, and the evolution of the grand matrix really corresponds to the information you gain differentiating, different possible hidden strings. Secondly, the grand matrix encodes the knowledge you have about the hidden string at any given possible time. That if you want to know what's the probability that you can answer a given question about the hidden string at a given time, you look at the grand matrix at that time, and that contains all the information you need to answer that question. In particular, if you want to be able to completely identify each of the x's without any error, then the grand matrix simply has to be equal to the identity because all of these states have to be orthogonal. Finally, this is really not a novel idea. The grand matrix is the typical object of study in adversary methods, and so it's a well-characterized object. Now, what can we say about the grand matrix? Well, the grand matrix is going to evolve according to this very pretty equation, which I'll explain in a minute. The idea is, let's define a Hilbert space A, which is going to contain all possible hidden strings. The grand matrix is going to be a positive operator on this Hilbert space A. Let's also define a Hilbert space M, which is going to be a list of the possible queries you can make. we're going to define a positive operator d twiddle, which is going to be a positive operator on a tensor rank. Finally, I'm going to define an h twiddle, which is going to be the obvious combination of all the different Hamiltonian oracles. That is, if the hidden string is x, apply Hamiltonian oracle h of x. Now, with this notation on the board, I can say, well, what are the possible derivatives of the grand matrix that you can have at a given time? Well, they're given by all the possible things you can have on the right-hand side of this first equation, which are given by all possible choices of g twiddle consistent with this equation. The partial trace of g twiddle over the space M has to be the original grand matrix. And so this is a very nice characterization. For starters, the set of derivatives you can have is a convex set. And even more, it's a bounded convex set. Because I'm assuming that Hamiltonians all have eigenvalues between pi and minus pi, and this trace basically bounds the largest eigenvalue of g twiddle in terms of the dimension of the space in the original grand matrix. So we end up with, at every time, there's this bounded convex set out of which we can choose our evolution for the grand matrix. And what you do is all the possible strategies, all the possible crazy unitary and parameterization, and anything else you could have done, really is equivalent to at each point, picking a point of this complex set and saying the grand matrix and evolve exactly. And I think that that's a pretty result, and I'm going to derive that from the next three slides. Yes?
So, I mean, is the tracing over M playing a really important role here? Could you just use as your main equation dt tilde dt equals minus I h tilde d tilde?
Now the tracing over M allows you to basically change the M part of the space in any way you want. So it basically allows you, you would have that equation, you would also have to interpolate it with some other equation that allows you to change the M space of this at different times. Maybe if I make this, let me move on to the next slide, and maybe this will become clear in a second, and if not, we'll get back to this, say, three slides down. So, to derive this equation, I'm going to reformulate this problem as an Allison-Bob problem. Probably because I spent about 2 years working in point building, that I started to see everything as an Allison-Bob problem. So, why not formulate this as an Allison-Bob problem, too? And so the idea is Alice is the oracle, Bob is the hero seeking knowledge. Alice knows the hidden string x, Bob can ask Alice questions. One of the possible questions, say, which bit we're trying to query. Alice will always answer honestly. There is no cheating going on here, but Alice won't give Bob any more information than, you know, this question merits. So I'm going to formulate this as a communication problem, and a single query really corresponds to the following two messages. Bob sends a query over to Alice in the Hilbert space M. Alice then applies the oracle unitary, looking at her hidden string x in the query that was sent, and returns the register M to Bob. The nice thing of that is that now you can take Kataya's description of point flipping and his translation of point flipping into semi-definite programming and run through that here as well. You end up with a semi-definite program that's really equivalent to the one by Segedie et al. But it's the one that I'm more familiar with, so I use it in this notation. But the basic idea is, let me just do the exact same thing, now focusing on Alice's density operator, and what state Alice has at each time. So Alice starts off with a density operator rho of t. Bob sends a query to M. Bob sends a query to Alice in Hilbert space M. So what does Alice have? Now Alice has a density operator rho twiddle on the space A tensor M, which satisfies this constraint equation simply because Bob could not have affected what Alice has on the space A. The partial trace of this, basically can affect stuff going M, but he can't affect stuff that goes A. And it's simply followed by the law of quantum mechanics. Now, what does Alice do? We said Alice applies the oracle unitary and returns M. Well, the oracle unitary, again, we take sort of one big oracle to summarize all the little oracle unitaries, and it's simply the unitary that applies oracle O sub x if Alice's state is x. And so she applies that unitary, we trace out m, which consists of sending m back to Bob, and now we increment time by one unit, because this was one query. And so this notion that I was talking about before, why you need to have this sort of trace m, is that the trace m is the place where Bob gets to choose what queries he wants to have, and allows Bob to choose different queries. For instance, if somebody take, you know, row tensor, you know, 1, and that will give query the first bit. You can have row tensor 2, and that will query the second bit. And so every time you do this, you get that you give Bob a chance to change the query.
Well, yes, but I mean, basically your equation says trace m of the left hand side equals trace m of the right hand side.
No.
Yeah. Because g of t is trace m of t tilde, and you trace the mean with g of t, right?
Yes, but it's not. G tilde doesn't necessarily have to be continuous, I think, is the issue.
Okay.
I mean, it could be continuous, and it probably will be continuous, but it's. Otherwise, you basically have no place to input any. Otherwise, it's sort of a. Deterministic. Yeah, I mean, you could do that. But it seems more natural this way to split it up into sort of a piece that is sort of fixed and a piece that you get to control. And I guess that's what I'm trying to do. G twiddle is a piece that you get to control and it has satisfied a constraint. G is a piece that you really have no control over that you drive with this particular evolution. I'd be happy to discuss this more a little bit later, I guess. Okay, so now what I want to do is I want to derive that equation I have there. And to do that, we start really thinking about fractional queries. So what's a fractional query? Well, for standard query, the application of phase is 1 and minus 1. Half a query, the application of phase 1 and I. A quarter of a query, the application of phase 1 and root I. And so on. We can make this more formal if we find a Hamiltonian that's related to the orbital by the standard equation that I keep writing down. And so a standard query is evolution by this Hamiltonian for 1 second. A fraction delta of a query is simply evolution under this Hamiltonian by delta seconds. So we can simply take, if we wanted to allow Bob to do fractional queries to analysts, what we could do is simply have the exact same formalism I had before, but now replace this equation with this equation down here. And there are two changes. One is I've only evolved the state by a fraction delta, because that's all the query that Alice is going to give them, and we've only incremented time by an amount delta, because that's all the time that it takes to do this query. And so a model where we do these kinds of queries with fixed delta is a model where the Hamiltonian is always on, but once every delta seconds, you get to apply a unitary. If I take the limit of delta goes to 0, then I end up with the Hamiltonian Oracle model, which is a model where the Hamiltonian is always on, and as often as I want, I get to apply a control unitary. And so that's exactly what we do. You take this equation, you take the limit of delta goes to 0, and you end up with this differential equation below. Now, this differential equation should look remarkably similar to the differential equation I had before. And in fact, it really is the same equation, because if you define things properly, then Alice's reduced density operator at all times is proportional to the grand matrix of the system. And so this is, in fact, the same equation. That's all I'm going to say today about the model of the methods. And with the time I have remaining for this talk, I'm going to be talking about the Oracle interrogation problem. And in particular, the n equals 2 case of Oracle interrogation. And so this is a very, very simple problem. There are only 4 possible hidden strings, 0, 0, 0, 1, 1, 0, and 1, 1. The grand matrix is a 4x4 matrix. But even that seemed kind of complicated to me. And so what I want to do first is to symmetry reduce this. So this problem has a lot of symmetries. You can think of them as symmetry even of the classical problem. And you can really flip the first bit independently of everything else. Say of the second bit. You can flip the second bit independently of the first bit. And you can actually change the two bits. And these are all symmetries of the problem. And so when you have symmetries of the problem, it turns out that you can always find optimal protocols that obey these symmetries. And so you can restrict yourself to looking at grand matrices that obey these symmetries, that are invariant under these symmetries, And if you study only these grand matrices that are invariantly symmetric, and you minimize over this sort of smaller space, you're still bound to find the optimal protocol that you're looking for. So this leads to a lot of simplifications. In particular, what does the symmetry imply when I apply it to the grand matrix? Well, I have to apply it to x and y at the same time. But it says, flipping the first bit. Well, that means that it doesn't really matter what the first bit, what x and y are on the first bit. It just simply matters whether they agree or disagree on the first bit. Similarly, flipping the second bit in the symmetry, that means that it doesn't really matter whether x and y, what x and y are on the second bit. It simply matters whether they agree or disagree. Exchanging the two bits simply tells us that the only dependence of x and y is simply how many bits do they agree on or disagree on. And so the matrix G really only depends on three parameters. One parameter for the case when x equals y, one parameter for the case when x differs by y by one bit, and one parameter when x and y are different in both bits. It's easiest to write those three parameters in the basis that is a plus minus basis, in which case this fully symmetric grand matrix is diagonal in this form. And the three parameters are chosen to be A0, A1, and A2, with some crazy coefficients. The crazy coefficients are simply to enforce this normalization. The normalization of the grand matrix is always satisfies the space of the grand matrix to equal dimension. And so this implies that A0 squared plus A1 squared plus A2 squared equals 1. That is, that these parameters live on the 2 sphere, say, embedded in R3. And so I'd like to say that each point of the 2 sphere corresponds to a particular grand matrix. And that's almost true. There is a sort of an eightfold degeneracy that appears because of the fact that I use squares here, I can flip minus signs of these parameters and get the same grand matrix. And we'll have to account for that eightfold degeneracy later. But otherwise, pretty much, the space of possible symmetric grand matrices is equivalent to the unit 2 sphere. Now, what do we want to do? Well, we know the initial condition is simply the old ones matrix, which in this particular basis of plus and minus states is equal to the A0 equals 1 and the other two parameters equal to 0. The final condition is the identity matrix, which again with these parameters is the first A0 and A2 are half, A1 is 1 over root 2. So now what we want to do is we know what our initial grand matrix is, we know what final grand matrix we want to get if we want to have zero error, and we simply have to figure out what are the dynamics that are going to get us from one point to the other. Well, the dynamics are very simple. They're given by that other equation I had at the G twiddle. But I won't derive it directly from that. I'll just simply put the result on the board. You can simply optimize the roll of the G twiddle to get all the possible derivatives you could get of A0, A1, and A2. And again, you get this nice convex set. And this convex set of derivatives characterized as follows. You still have the same vector over here, multiplied by this other matrix, which you get to control. W1 and W2 are the two parameters you get to choose, and it can be chosen arbitrarily, subject to the single constraint that W1 squared plus W2 squared is less than or equal to 1. So what does this equation mean, say, more physically? Well, I want you to think of these three parameters as well living in the sphere, but I want you to think of A1 as corresponding to the direction of the north pole. And A0 and A2 are going to span the equator. And so a matrix of this form is really a rotation matrix. It's simply you're getting to choose different rotation matrices. The fact that there is a 0 in the furthest off-diagonal element means that the only rotation that you're allowed to do are rotations whose axis lies on the equator. You can rotate around any axis that goes in the equator. Of course, by rotating around doing rotations around the equator, you can generate rotations around other directions as well. But these are done as composite rotations, not as elementary rotations. What does this constraint on the magnitude do? This simply says that the rotation, your rotation speed, has to be less than or equal to pi over 2 radians per second. And so now this is basically a new problem. We know what the starting point is, you know what the ending point is, we had those a second ago. And you know what you're allowed to do. You're allowed to rotate the sphere through axes that lie in the equator at speeds less than or equal to pi over 2 radians per second. How long does it take to get from the initial point to the final point? And this is yet another formulation of this Hamiltonian oracle problem, but now it's a very different Hamiltonian oracle problem. Now it's really a Hamiltonian control problem. We've lost all the hidden parameters. In our control Hamiltonian, it's now a restrictive sort. Whereas before we could do arbitrarily strong Hamiltonian, now we have some bounds on what a Hamiltonian is allowed to do. So this is a new problem that has the same solution as the original problem. Now, I want to do something even better. I want to relate this problem to a geometry problem. And what I want to do is I want to define a metric on the sphere so that the distance between any two points is equal to the minimum time it would take me to evolve from one point to the other, given these dynamics. And so I'm going to do that in a second. The next couple of slides are the ones where I'm saying they do involve some differential geometry, and my apologies to those who are not terribly familiar with this. I'll be happy to explain this in more detail after the talk. If not, you're just going to have to bear with me for about three slides. And so what I really want to do is to relate this to metrics. I can actually do this locally. And so I introduce polar coordinates, again with A1 being the North Pole. And I find out that this set of possible derivatives, possible velocity vectors, can be written in terms of the two coordinate basis vectors, E theta and E phi, of the tangent space at the point at which I'm currently located. So given by this particular form. It depends on two new parameters, omega theta and omega phi, which are simply rotated versions of omega 1 and omega 2. But the point is that when their L2 norm had to be less than 1, then this have an L2 norm less than 1 as well. In fact, it's always optimal to choose these to have an L2 norm equals to 1, because you never want to rotate at speeds that are slower than possible. You always want to rotate at the highest possible speed, and then it always corresponds to saturating the inequality. So we'll just simply assume that the inequality is always saturated. That has to be true for optimal curves. And we're left with this set of velocity vectors. Now we ask, well, what is the metric that generates this set of this that such as this set of vectors is a set of unit vectors, sort of a unit sphere around a given point. And you simply look at these two equations, and it's very clearly this metric, this local metric, is the one that generates these set of vectors as unit vectors. And so what we get is basically that we can solve this problem using this local metric over here. And our task now is to find the minimum distance between the initial the two points that I mentioned before, which we have found out as the Gram matrix being all ones and the Gram matrix being forced to identity, and written out in polar coordinates. So what have we done? We've taken the oracle interrogation problem, which was had hidden parameters, arbitrarily strong control, to a new problem of Hamiltonian control, which has no hidden parameters, restrictive control, to a problem of differential geometry, where there are no more Hamiltonians, there's no more control, you're simply talking about distances between two different points. Now, if you know your differential geometry, it's fairly easy to sort of write down and solve this problem. You write down what's called a geodesic equation, which is a second order equation that's guaranteed to give you extremal curves between sets of points. These extremal may either be minimal or locally maximal. But you can sort of check that at the end. The point is that the minimal curve will be, of course, a geodesic. So if you know all the possible geodesics connecting two points, then one of them is going to be the minimal curve. So you can figure out what this is. This simply follows from some differential geometry. You can reduce this to first order differential equation. And in fact, you can get these equations directly, because the phi dot equation is an Euler-Lagrange equation for phi, and the other one is simply the constraint that the velocity has to be equal to 1 at all times as you're advancing on the curve. So what do these geodesics look like? Well, they're parameterized by a parameter theta naught. And so they all start at the equator. They rise up from the equator vertically. They keep going up until they reach a given theta naught, or rather cosine theta naught. And then they fall back down symmetrically to the other side of the equator. And these are what these geodesics basically look like. Because of the form of these equations, you can actually solve them explicitly. You put this phi dot equation into this other equation, and you get a first order differential equation for theta dot that can be solved by separation of variables. You take the solution into here, you get an equation for phi, which can be solved by separation of variables. And you can actually write down explicitly a complete family of geodesics for this manifold, which is kind of nice. the curves are not particularly pretty, so I'm not going to show them to you today. And they really, I don't think there's much insightful, there's not much insight you can gain by looking at the curves. So I'll spare you the ugly mess. But let me just say a couple of comments of what's going on. As I mentioned, this is the point where you really have to worry about this eightfold degeneracy that I mentioned before. You have to consider curves that connect any possible starting point to any possible ending points. And that's sort of related again to the fact that geodesics also find local minimum, not necessarily global minimum. So you really have to find the shortest geodesic curve between any possible set of eight points, but that's fairly easy to do. A little bit more worrisome is that actually my metric is poorly defined at the origin on the equator. There's an infinite, has an infinite eigenvalue, which is kind of annoying. So you can start a little bit above the equator and evolve from there. If you just ignore this infinity, things tend to work out quite nicely. But if you want to do things very, very carefully, then what you really do is you evolve to a point close to the equator, and then you use one of the other formulations to bound the distance between this point, that's sort of right above the equator, and the actual point on the equator that you're trying to get to. Anyways, once you've done all this, you get an answer. The answer can only be obtained numerically, as far as I can tell, because it involves, though you can solve everything analytically, the answer is a solution to a transcendental equation, and so I can only do it numerically. But the final answer is about 0.9. What does this 0.9 mean? It means that it takes 0.9 seconds, or 0.9 units of query time, to solve the n equals 2 case of oracle interrogation in the Hamiltonian oracle model if you want to get zero error. For comparison, I can list what the n equals 1 case takes, which takes exactly half a second in the units I've chosen. So this gives us the following result, is that 2 bits can actually be queried faster when they're queried together than when queried separately. And this is what I was talking about before, even if you're worried about zero error. Okay. So let me take a step back and try to summarize the greater message of today's talk, which is that Hamiltonian oracles are potentially a useful tool for proving lower bounds for regular unitary oracle problems. They have a lot of nice features. They use differential equations. They describe fractional queries, different speed queries, and a lot of these problems can also be related to geometry. At a minimum, I'm not sure if this reduction to geometry is useful, but I think it's lots of fun. So we'll have to really see if what comes out of this. In the end, there are a number of open problems that I think are particularly interesting. The first one is the one that I mentioned earlier. There are a lot of reasonable models of Hamiltonian oracles. I suspect that they're all equivalent, but writing down a careful mathematical proof of this fact would definitely be worthwhile. A second thing is all the examples that we know, which are essentially most of the ones in this paper, in this talk, plus the spatial search cases, are related simply by a constant factor speedup, or there's a relationship of a constant factor between the Hamiltonian and unitary oracles. The question is, does this universally hold? Does this always happen? I don't think there is even a proof out there that Hamiltonian oracles are always polynomially related to unitary oracles, and proving that would be a good first step. So of course, if there really are exponential separations, all that really means is that this Hamiltonian oracle business may not be as useful in proving lower bounds. I'm hoping it is. Finally, I've said a number of comments about sort of the advantages of zero error in this Hamiltonian oracle model. So really, it'd be interesting to explore if there really is anything interesting that could be said about zero error versus bounded error for this Hamiltonian oracle model. And finally, of course, one would want to prove some new lower bounds using these Hamiltonian oracles. But that's all I really have to say today. New lower bounds is probably future. Thank you very much. Questions? Yes?
So, sketch this algorithm for this n equals 2 interrogation case and only you specify it, but is that optimal?
Yes. Okay. Yes. It's exactly, it's both, you know, you could say it's both maximum upper and lower bound, but it's simply done by, you know, optimizing this particular thing and getting the optimal answer. And that's essentially what we've done.
Is there a simple description of the algorithm?
No, this one does, this one is not constant. It's not particularly, it's slow varying, but it's not constant. You can easily, well, you can, without too much difficulty, translate the path that you get in the sphere into an actual Hamiltonian, and it'll tell you exactly what you need to do. And I did that once. It wasn't particularly enlightening as far as I could tell. But in principle, if you really wanted to know what it is, you could sit down and write notes. Yes?
You said for the capital N equals 4 case, you had to solve the transcendental equation to get the final answer for the quadratic fractal. It was 0.9.
Yeah.
But at the beginning of the talk, you gave an explicit formula for various n. I think it was, what was it, n over square root of n minus 1 pi arc sine of something.
Oh, no, the arc sine one, that's for the Grover search problem. This is for the Hamiltonian oracle problem.
Oh, I see.
So they're just different results.
Okay, good.
Carlos?
Yes?
Is there an indication that if you go to 3 bits, you're going to get better than...
You can get speed ups?
Better than 3 halves of 0.9 or whatever.
Yeah, I suspect, yes. I don't see any reason why not. There's nothing particularly special about the n equals 2 case. Well, the only thing special about the n equals 2 case is that when you reduce it to a geometry problem, it turns out to be a Riemannian geometry problem, which I don't have to deal with. Whereas once you go past n equals 2, you end up with something more complicated, which is called a Finzer geometry problem, which sort of looks the same, but is a little bit more annoying. And so those are, say, hard to solve. And you could sort of almost go through all of this, and in principle you could derive something. You would end up with much harder differential equations, I think, is the problem. And I had a hard enough time trying to solve these differential equations. I suspect that solving the differential equation for n equals 3 is going to be even harder. Finding a not, you can always find a not optimal solution. But then that may not be much of an improvement over, say, running the the n equals 2 and then the n equals 1 in series or something like that.
So this bound of n over pi p that you get, is there any, do you have any feel for whether that's the asymptotic?
No, I suspect that that's a weak bound. It's very simple to derive. It sort of really takes half a page. It just simply involves neglecting some terms and combining the two equations. But basically, because I neglected some terms, I suspect that it's weak. Yes.
So for the Grover problem, you said to get a nice exact algorithm, but that's where you have a fixed number of marked items.
Yeah, one marked item is all I consider. This is not I don't think anybody's ever looked at even two marked items in this case.
In your hunch that if you didn't know the number of marked items, then as with the speed case, you'd get no speed up of n?
I suspect that it would basically be very similar. So that's really, I think that proving this relationship between unitary and Hamiltonian, I think, would answer all those questions at the same time. But I suspect that there's not much interesting to be found by simply looking at more items in this case. Questions?
Okay,